It's interesting to me that stealing, unlike some of the previous commandments that we've been, hey guys, we've been looking at, stealing is something that we begin at quite a young age. I have a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old at home, and they are already quite adept at breaking this commandment. And they know that they're breaking this commandment. It's not an accidental thing. I mean, Juddy is particularly adept at it. When you're growing up a curlin, you grow up sort of on the shorter in stature side, maybe not so strong physically. And so you learn that you're going to get by in life with cunning and with wits. And so Juddy has learned, for example, that he can't just go up to his older sister and grab what he wants and push her over because, well, he'll get a whooping from his sister. So he's learned that when her back is turned, he may strategically run and grab her favorite toy, which is he knows is hers and not his, and make like a bandit for the porch and hope that she doesn't see his little tuckus running out there. So he knows theft. He knows what belongs to her. He knows it doesn't belong to him. And he knows he's going to have to be somewhat conniving in order to get it. Hey, how's it going? Long time no see. And he's 2. Well, okay, he'll be 3 in like 2 days or something. But, you know, he's very, very young. And he's been doing this for a while. So theft is something that we come across at a very young age and that we all experience we've all done to some degree or other. We've all stolen things, whether we remember it or not, or whether it was on last year's taxes or when we were 5 years old and grabbed a piece of candy or whatever it was. So this is a pretty universal, I think, experience, the desire to take something that does not belong to you. Now, here are my points for the sermon. Liam, if you'd be so kind. I'm just going to put them up here, and you can kind of follow along. You can't have a question already. All I've said is don't steal.
You said, you know, we all have this desire to do this.
Right.
But are we talking about just the desire or the action?
Well, when I said the desire, I meant the desire. But I think we've all participated in the action at some point in time, if my experience is... Are you... This is why I edit the audio parts of the sermon online. We'll have a prayer session for David after the service. Stay with me and see if you have the same question by the time we're done here, or comment, if you will, rather. Okay. All right, so the first point of the sermon I think I've sort of already made and is the quickest point of all. Don't steal. Hopefully no one's going to contest that. I'm going to talk about I want to talk about more than that in this context and what that looks like. So that leads to a discussion on property in general. So I want to talk about some property as a godly blessing, limits on property, the things we own as a blessing, and then talk about trustworthiness, and finally, discipleship. And I may have to skip a couple of these points if I run too long, so that's why I have a timer with Benner's there. Okay, so the ground level rule we've already talked about. Not stealing between you and I and between you and the rest of society creates a safe space. And as we've talked about before, the Ten Commandments are largely, a significant part of what they're about is creating a safe space between you and me so that other things can flourish, like genuine love and discipleship and these sorts of things. The Ten Commandments are about making a place where we can grow and be disciples. So if you're a Christian and if you believe in Christ and you hear the word of the Lord, then you cannot steal and rationalize it, which is how most of us steal. Not many of us, I think, just steal and think, well, I'm a thief, and that's too bad. Usually it comes with a significant amount of rationalization. Can't cheat on your taxes and say you don't approve what the government's doing with your money. You can't cheat your insurance company and say they're too rich already and say that they overcharge you every year. These are all things, by the way, that I've said, if you're wondering where I'm getting this list from. You cannot lie to a college about how much you have in savings to get a scholarship, which I never did, but it popped in my mind as something that people are often tempted to do. You cannot steal regardless of how mean your neighbor is to you or how rich your neighbor is or how much your neighbor has compared to how little you have. You may not steal. There's no room for rationalization in those two Hebrew words up there. Now, if only it were that simple, right? But we're going to get more into the complexities. So private property. I think this is an important thing to talk about. You cannot steal implies a certain degree of private property. If there are things that belong to you, and things that belong to me, and things that belong to other people, in a way that is right, presumably, or righteous. Now, the brokenness of the formal systems of property in our world, and I'm not just talking about the United States, the world, all over, often comes along with wealth alongside poverty and all these horrible things that we see every day, if your eyes are open. Sometimes that leads us to the attitude that nothing should that private property is inherently evil, and that nothing really should be mine, and nothing really should be yours, and that we should own everything sort of corporately, or just say it's all God's, and it doesn't really belong to anyone. And there's sort of a grain of truth in that. And supporting that view is, in fact, our own mortality, right? Our limited time here on Earth. We can't take our possessions with us. There is a very real sense in which we don't own anything in a kind of eternal way. That is true, and I've preached on that in the past. But there are other truths about property that involve honoring one another and the system of life that we have together. And so I want to look some at the rules of property in ancient Israel as given by God's law. And I don't think that our sense of property, again, our internal sense of what is yours and what is mine, stems from an inherently evil or coveting type place. And the word inherently is important because it certainly can become that. But I don't think it's inherently evil or bad. Liam, go ahead and give me the next slide here. I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with this passage. This is from Genesis chapter 1. The creation, God blessed them, us, humans, and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea, the birds in the sky, over every living creature that moves on the ground. And God said, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree. They'll be yours for food. And all the beasts of the earth and all the birds in the sky and all the creatures that move along the ground, everything that has the breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food. Sort of God's creative impulse involves giving us, human beings, dominion, if you will, sometimes it's translated dominion, certain ownership of the earth. Like there's a sense of, hey, here, you know, do with it what you will. You are the stewards of this earth. Now, when I say do with it what you will, I don't mean go crazy and destroy it. Stewards is an important word there. And I think we all know that, that we are to be stewards as best we can of this earth. But that does come with a certain sense of ownership and responsibility. And then there's other things, and I didn't want to put all these scriptures up here, so you just have to take my word in some of this. But wealth does not seem to be, in the Old Testament, intrinsically bad. And you have examples like Abraham or Job, righteous people of wealth who use their wealth to bless others and to honor God. And it just seems to be part of the way things are. In fact, even directly after the fall, you have Cain and Abel bringing their fruits, the fruit of their labor, to God in worship. The idea being that they own or they have proprietary ownership of whatever it is they're bringing to God in worship, and that that's a good thing. That's not the part of the story that goes bad, but that they're bringing their goods to God. And so presumably they're blessing God and blessing other people through the things that they own. So I don't think you can have sort of a simple answer that, or a simple philosophy of life, that ownership is just somehow intrinsically bad. But there is in the Old Testament a constant from the fall on, concern for the poor, and also, and this is the less spoken about part, so I'm going to emphasize this more in the sermon, a cap, a very real, practical, honest-to-goodness cap on how wealthy a person or a group of people can become. And that is very important, and that is very biblical and very much rarely talked about. So I'm going to rectify that right here and now. So let's look, we'll spend a little bit of time here. I just think it's that important that we're going to spend a significant amount of time reading about this. So Liam, if you'd give me this. Okay, I know this is hard to read, so I'll just try and speak up here. This is the passages in Leviticus that deal with the Jubilee. How many of you know what the Jubilee is? Most everybody. Okay, well, if you don't know, you will shortly. So this is God's law through the priests to the land of Israel as an economic unit. Count off 7 Sabbath years, basically 49 years, then have the trumpet sounded everywhere on the 10th day of the 7th month. On the Day of Atonement, sound the trumpet throughout your land. Something big is going to happen on the 50th year, every 50th year in Israel. Consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you. Each of you is to return to your family property and to your own clan. Now, when Israel was formed, all the tribes each had a part of Israel. Within those tribes, each clan had a section of land, and each family had a section. It was all partitioned up between all the families of Israel when it was founded. Where was I? The 50th year shall be a jubilee. Do not sow, do not reap what grows of itself or harvest the untended vines. It is a jubilee. Even the land is to rest. It is to be holy for you. Eat only what is taken directly from the fields. In this year of jubilee, everyone is to return to their own property. If you sell land to any of your own people or buy land from them, do not take advantage of each other. Remember, land is the one source of wealth. Land is the source. There's no stock market. There's no... You got land, you're wealthy. You don't got land, you're poor. Land is wealth. If you sell land to any of your own people or buy land from them, do not take advantage of each other. You are to buy from your own people on the basis of the number of years since the Jubilee, and they are to sell to you on the basis of the number of years left for harvesting crops. When the years are many, you are to increase the price. The years are few, less money. Basically, they're just saying, look, this is going to affect the entire economic system of Israel. Because this 50th year jubilee comes every 50 years, you will be tempted to take advantage of it. Don't do it. Be fair in how you deal with your brothers and sisters. Okay, the next one. Follow my decrees and be careful to obey my laws, and you will live safely in the land. And the land will yield its fruit, and you will eat your fill and live there in safety. The land must not be sold permanently. Now here's an interesting sentence. Because the land is mine, and you reside in my land as foreigners and strangers. Throughout the land that you hold as a possession, you must provide for the redemption of the land. I highlighted that because that is the paradox we live in, that everything belongs to the Lord, but we have responsibility for our possessions. In the same sentence, God says, this land, is everything belongs to me, but you possess some of it. If that makes sense, I think that's very important. If one of your fellow Israelites becomes poor and sells some of their property, their nearest relative is to come and redeem what they have sold. So you're to have your families to come and help you out and redeem whatever needs to go back in the Jubilee. If, however, there is no one to redeem it for them, but later on they prosper and acquire sufficient means to redeem it themselves, I don't know if you need to realize, but basically it just means there has to be a fairness and equity in how things are redeemed, how they're bought. If they don't require the means to repay, what was sold will remain in the possession of the buyer. And this is a very important sentence. If they don't acquire the means to repay, what was sold will remain in possession of the buyer until the year of the Jubilee. And then basically, it just has to go back, no matter who's got the money. It'll be returned to the Jubilee. They can go back to their property. Next slide, please, Liam. If any of your fellow Israelites become poor and are unable to support themselves among you, help them as you would a foreigner and stranger, which is a fascinating sentence in of itself. How does Israel feel about foreigners and strangers? Help them not as you would your brother or sister. Help them as if they were someone you didn't even know. I think that's a fascinating sentence. Do not take interest or any profit from them, but fear your God so that they may continue to live among you. You must not lend them money at interest or sell them food at a profit. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. Now, it's often said, and it's just erroneous, that the Bible says you can't charge money at interest, or you can't give loans at interest. You can make money off interest in the Bible. It is legal. What is not allowed is you're not allowed to take money from the poor in interest. If you are giving a loan or giving money to the poor or selling them food, as this passage indicates, you're not allowed to make a profit off the poor. If you take a loan from someone who's moderately wealthy or has the means, you're allowed to make money off it. So that's, Mark?
Yeah. But in Acts,
I think, yeah.
The difference.
Yeah, when we get to radical discipleship, we're going to shift gears, right? But, yeah, just in terms of the economic landscape of Israel, you could charge interest, you could make money, yeah. But you just, the poor were poor widows, you know, this group of vulnerable people. You were not allowed to make money off of them. Okay, so that's the Jubilee. And there are actually more passages to deal with the Jubilee, but... Yeah, as you're probably grateful, I'm not going to read them all here. It gets very detailed because it's a complicated economic move. And it radically changes the entire thing. What's that?
6 minutes.
I've been talking for 14 minutes? Okay. All right. It's like I must have been talking for longer than 6 minutes. Our time is moving very slowly. Okay. So what I take from this, well, I take a number of things from this, but there are limits on property as blessing, which is to say, it is possible for people to acquire too much property and become too wealthy. That's what that seems to say. I mean, I don't know how else or why else the Jubilee would even be in effect. It basically puts a limit on how powerful and how wealthy people can become. Now, that is really radical. That is very difficult to follow for any group of people. There is no evidence that this was ever done that we know of. I mean, maybe it was, and we don't know, but you can read all through, you know, 1st and 2nd Samuel and Kings and Chronicles and the entire history of Israel, and you're not going to read about this being enacted. It's not in any of our archaeological or extra-biblical texts. It just sits there in Leviticus doing absolutely nothing, as far as we can tell. Because people found it to be, I think, too difficult. And people of wealth and people of power probably said, if you'll forgive me, like hell. I am not giving back my land to the Benjaminites or whoever it was had it, you know, 50 years ago. And that was that. At least that's my take on it. It's a very difficult thing. So I guess what I'm trying to push against here are sort of two extremes that I see historically and I think in our own hearts, which is why they play themselves out historically. You know, in one sense, you have this sense of private property is bad and evil, and we should just try and all, you know, sort of the Marxist, communist, socialist point of view. And on the other hand, you have this sort of, which is the direction our country has gone, the road more traveled here, this sort of unbridled sense of just bottom dollar, man. Whatever you can make, get it, and unbridled capitalism. I don't think as Christians that either of those really fit what Yahweh is trying to teach us about economics and private ownership. I do think there is something about us having things that is somehow human and also honoring of God and honoring of each other. And more importantly, perhaps allows us to honor each other in a way that you can't if everything's corporate. On the other hand, if you don't have any sort of check, like Jubilee is a huge check mark on human pride and power, if you don't have those kinds of check marks, whether it looks like the Jubilee or whatever else you have, well, we've seen firsthand in this country how that can get out of control very quickly. So, this is a sermon on theft and stealing, believe it or not. In light of this, and in light of other scriptures, which I'll mention in a minute, it's worth noting that a huge part of the economy, historically speaking, of this country is based on theft, and a type of theft that comes married to capital punishment. In the Old Testament, I'm talking about slavery. Slavery in the United States, as I've said many times, is not the same thing as slavery in Israel. In fact, in Israel, if you kidnap someone, take them somewhere else, and use them for profit, if you read Exodus chapter 21, the punishment for that is death, like flat out. And the entire slavery system of the Americas was based on kidnapping and profit. That was what slavery was, human kidnapping, human trafficking. And there is a very strict, I mean, if we had been following the biblical laws, every single one of those sea captains and traders and merchants would have been executed, which is why I always get a little upset when people say, well, you know, the Bible condones slavery and, you know, Christian, no. It's entirely, we should have a different word for it. We don't, but we should. That's theft. And it, boy, what damage did it do to our country? I mean, it's we're still dealing with that. We will for probably decades and decades to come. So the truth is that theft, which is to say the taking of what is not rightfully ours, has a deep historical root in this country. Not just in slavery, in any number of ways, in the human experience, and it occurs still every day in America. Some of it happens right in front of us in very obvious ways, you know, it just in ways that are hard to deny. Someone's held up a gunpoint and their wallet's taken. Well, we're not going to argue about what that is. That's theft, and it's a sin. Some of it's quite legal, and it happens not before our eyes, behind closed doors, and we never even hear about it. Well, we do eventually, perhaps, but even then we can barely understand it. You know, various forms of corporate theft and people cheating others on payroll and Wall Street theft, which I don't even begin to understand. I just know there's a lot of people making a lot of money with things that seem very dicey. All these things. The only thing I can say about that as a pastor and as a Christian, let's not be involved in it. Let's not have a foot in that water as much as we can. Now, I know we have to live in a society, and we have to, you know, we can't just cut ourselves off from the rest of the way the system works, But inasmuch as you find yourself in a position of power and responsibility, or in charge of other people, or you know, taking care of the books or what have you, have no part in it. You know, if something seems fishy to you, call it out and make that known. So that's, I think, the Old Testament view of property, theft, and the borders or the limits on property. Now, in terms of Christ and Jesus and our following of the Lord that way, in a way it's more simple, in a way it's more complicated. The simple part is that Jesus' message on wealth is pretty simple, which is that you may have it or you may not. Doesn't seem to... The fact of whether or not you have much wealth or not doesn't seem to have any sort of salvific, eternal ramifications. It's your attitude and your relationship to your money. And Jesus' message is pretty consistent that wealth is dangerous. It's just dangerous to the human soul. It has a toxifying effect. Something to remember about people like Abraham and Job is that they were deeply faithful. There's a reason Abraham's called the father of faith. Not many people can be as wealthy as Abraham and still have the same attitude that he did towards money and towards his goods. Like, for example, just off the top of my head, with Abraham and Lot's, you know, their possessions got so, they had so many shepherds and so many large flocks, they started to have friction among them, that they were living too close together. Their kingdoms basically were running into each other. So Abraham said to Lot, well, who remembers what Abraham said to Lot? I'll tell you what Abraham said to Lot. he tells Lot, so he's got the whole land of Israel in front of him. And of course, in any country, there's good land and there's bad land, right? There's fertile land and poor land. And Abraham says to Lot, pick whatever land you want. If you go west, I'll go east. If you go north, I'll go south. You just pick, and I'll go the other way. And that, which is a remarkable thing for a man of wealth and means, to basically risking his livelihood and saying, I just, you know, I trust you, leave me with something worth having.
Time's up.
Well, it's not up. I just, it's 20 minutes. I have another 20. Set it for another 20. Okay. Five, maybe. At any rate, so wealth, Jesus' message to us is that wealth is toxifying, and it takes a significantly powerful, faithful person to keep it from being such. And there are such people. I mean, we do see people like that in history who are truly wealthy, truly powerful, and lived commendable, generous lives. They're just few and far between. And if you add them up against the people who seem to take wealth to just be a given and, well, give the finger to everybody else, the numbers don't add up. Okay, let's go to Luke 16, Liam. So in terms of our possessions and whatever form of theft, whoever can be trusted with very little, this is Jesus speaking, whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. Whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? So this is my second to last point, which is that as Christians, even if we're not actively stealing or actively doing anything that's against the law, there's a certain level of just following Christ that just has to do with trustworthiness, of someone who can be relied upon and is cogent about other people's needs and responsive and trustworthy. So I won't break that too much. Okay, I think I'm going to skip this next part because I am probably at 25 minutes. Hold on a second. Okay, we'll just end with this then. Liam, you can go to the next one there. Okay, this is Jesus again in Luke chapter 6. And I think this is the pinnacle of discipleship. And if you can see this teaching as a pyramid, this is the very tip of it. But to you who are listening, I say, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who mistreat you. If someone slaps you on one cheek, turn them to the other, turn to them the other also. If someone takes your coat, don't withhold your shirt from them. Give to everyone who asks you. And if anyone takes what belongs to you, do not demand it back. Do to others as you would have them do to you. Now, you have to follow the Ten Commandments to get to this place in discipleship. If you're someone who steals, then it's really not that significant that you're giving to someone more than what they ask. If you give to someone your coat and you're like, well, that's okay, I just stole it from the guy a little bit ago, that's not giving. I don't know what that's called. So the assumption is that if you have everything else, if you're an honest person, and you come by your property as honestly as you can, the vagaries of history notwithstanding, and you are generous and kind, then this is the final step to take, to be unexpected. As Christians, we're supposed to be unexpected, that people just did not see that coming. Generous to a fault, but not so much in a sort of a doormat kind of way, and there's other teachings of Christ, but in a way that's just like, hey, you know what? If you really need this $20, well, you know, I'll give you 100, because maybe you could really put that to good use. You know, if you really need this particular thing, then I'm going to double down on it and give you more than you expected. And that's how we're to be, in a way that's shocking to people. And I know there's all kinds of caveats and all kinds of, I mean, people can be taken advantage of. People can use you in such a way that's not helping them. You know, there are people who are, you know, deep wells of need that you could throw your entire life into and not fix, because what they really need is a relationship with the Lord. But all the caveats aside, and all that notwithstanding, that's who people should expect of us. That's what people should expect of us. I remember, this will be my last anecdote and then I'll be done, but this took me by such surprise that I always like to use it as an example, but it was a prior church I was attending. There was a lady whose funeral I was, or it wasn't her funeral, but some sort of wake or honoring service at the church. And all these stories came out. And, you know, to me, she was always nice and pleasant and everything, but to me, she was just kind of the little old lady who sat in the corner, who was a nice and pleasant enough lady. But I couldn't believe the stories that people were getting up there saying about the generous things that she had done for them and their family throughout the years, through years and years and years, you know, going back decades. Remarkable, radical stuff. I mean, she was not a wealthy woman. I mean, she wasn't impoverished, but you would have thought she was a millionaire for all the people who got up there and told these stories. And she never told a soul. Well, maybe she did. It certainly wasn't common knowledge around the church. I kept seeing people, you know, doing this. And it was one of those moments. It was like, that's, you know, that's truly the Christian, you know, that she had that kind of impact on people's lives. But really, the left hand didn't even know what the right hand was doing. That nobody really knew except God. And she did. She was honored. She was finally honored on her deathbed, you know, when she died. And that had an impact on people's lives. Clearly, impacted my life. But it was an incredible thing. How unexpected. And to me, that's the top of the pyramid, to live a life in a way that people will look at you and say, there's something about this person that's not even human. It's not that he or she is even trustworthy, or not even that he or she is a good steward of their gifts, but you're not even sure what crazy thing they're going to do next that's going to bless someone. Now, I know that's a very high calling, and I'm not at all claiming that when people look at me, that's the first thought that runs through their head, but that's the calling, and that's what I'm preaching.